Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello. This is Diane Stemple, and you're listening to Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm doing my monthly book review show. I'm so pleased to introduce renowned cheese book author Laura Werlin to discuss her latest book, Mac and Cheese, Please. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Diane.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited to be here with you, here, as it were, anyway, on the radio, because I'm such a huge fan of the show, and I listen to the podcast every week, and so it's just great to be with you.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm excited to have you. I just wanted to introduce you for our listeners, in case they don't know, which is probably not true. They probably know of you well. You've been writing more than a decade of great cheese books, the first being The New American Cheese in 2000, which was a combination of recipes and a survey of many American cheesemakers all over the country. And then the second major cheese book was All American Cheese and Wine in 2003. And those were both, in everybody's library to learn about American cheese and also some wine. So I want to thank you for those excellent books.
Oh, my goodness. You're so welcome. It was, those were both, all of my books really are, you know, the phrase labors of love, it's not even really appropriate because it didn't really, they never feel like labor. They mm-hmm. just, but they do feel like love. but those first two books in particular that you mentioned were certainly so because of, they were and are, I suppose, to some extent, discoveries for me of, an entire sort of burgeoning industry that all I knew was that I loved cheese and I loved American cheese, but I didn't know much about it, and I really didn't think too many people did either.
Mm-hmm.
And so those books were sort of the manifestations of my discoveries, but ones that I wanted to, other people to be able to discover along with me.
Mm-hmm. And the research must have been fascinating and wonderful. I mean, what could be better than traveling around the country eating cheese and meeting cheesemakers?
It's pretty terrible, but somebody had to do it. It was interesting. Actually, the first book I wrote very shortly after leaving my previous profession, which was television news.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my background in TV news, I was very used to deadlines because, of course, we had, several deadlines every day in news. And when I got a publisher for The New American Cheese, they were so enthusiastic about the idea that they gave me, in the end, after we'd signed the contract and everything, basically I had to write it in about 3 months.
Wow.
And that was rather insane. So a lot of that particular book was done by phone and asking cheesemakers to send me their cheeses. And, rather than, I was able to visit quite a few, but not, mm-hmm. There were 55 cheesemakers that I profiled in that book, and I wasn't able to get to all of them by any stretch of the imagination. In subsequent years,
mm-hmm.
I have
mm-hmm.
Been able to visit many of them, but not at that time.
Ah.
Nevertheless, it was it was still a fun little journey, even if a lot of it was by phone. And I might add, prior to the real use of the internet, so
right.
everything I did was really by phone and mm-hmm. by tasting and that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Now, I really thought you fooled me because I thought you had traveled around because you had concentrated on California, Vermont, and Wisconsin. So I figured you were just driving around those states.
Not extensively, no. As I said, I did get to visit some of them, but not all that I wrote about. And that was because I mean, it would have been nice to be able to write a, you know, a sort of a You Are There kind of chronicle of every farm that, that I ended up writing about, but because of the time constraints, and also at that point, you know, that I didn't really have the means to do that kind
right.
of thing. And so,
and I felt
budget. Like it wasn't so important. I mean, I sent the photographer around mm-hmm. to many of the farms that I myself did not have the opportunity to visit at that point.
Oh, okay. Now, I want to talk about your new book. The very day I first cracked open your book, Mac and Cheese, to read the intro, I had coincidentally passed by a box of Velveeta in a very unfancy grocery store near my house in Brooklyn, and I had reached out for it. I had touched it. It was, you know, a cardboard box, you know, rectangular, and I wanted it. It was like a primordial desire to put it in my cart, but I stopped myself because I have never purchased Velveeta or used it in any way. But then when I opened your book and saw that you were including some Velveeta recipes, I immediately regretted it, that I hadn't brought some home.
Well, I'll have you know that in writing this book, that was the first time I had ever purchased Velveeta. And, you know, and I even said, I think I said in the book, I can't remember, I know I thought it, that that I was quite certain that some of my colleagues in our cheese world would disparage me for that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and understandably so, frankly. The reason that those two recipes that have Velveeta in them appear in the book is because one of them is a friend of mine's recipe who, he brings it to a New Year's Eve party every year. And the first time I tasted it several years ago, I couldn't quit eating it. And then I finally asked him, I said, all right, so what are the cheeses in here? And he said, Velveeta. And I said, no. I felt like everything I had learned and done in cheese up to that point was for naught. But it was so good, and everybody at the party loved it and loves it every year that I thought, mm-hmm. you know, I've got to do that. And then
it
the other one was and the other one is a retro recipe. I call it Mad Men Mac and Cheese, mm-hmm. and it's got, you know, it's a riff on the Mad Men series,
mm-hmm,
so
right.
I thought they're not going to use anything but Velveeta. So.
Well, I presume they created Velveeta because it's good for cooking.
Well, actually, it was a means of using leftover Swiss cheese scraps, basically. When they would cut the cheese to be a certain size and everything in the
mm-hmm.
factory, it was they came up with a way to basically reheat those scraps, use them,
mm-hmm.
and reheated them and added whatever they added to them to create a shelf-stable product, and one that you know, obviously doesn't have to be refrigerated, at least before it's open,
mm-hmm.
And yes, and it melts well. But
mm-hmm.
really, what it did back when it was invented was it appealed to the American, even back then, we as a culture had a real desire for sameness in our food and consistency and reliability and all of those things,
mm-hmm.
and Velveeta really answered that call, and
mm-hmm.
so and then during war years, it was easily transported and that kind of thing.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was very practical cheese, really.
Okay,
or non-cheese.
Uh huh. Well, I have a lot of questions about the book. I'm curious about what a different experience it is to do the research and writing the previous two books versus a complete cookbook and on just one topic.
Right.
How long does it take?
You know, actually, it is a little bit. It is a different focus, but in many ways, the single subject book like this Mac and Cheese and my other two, which are grilled cheese books, are much easier
mm-hmm.
because I don't have to. You know, I know what the basic thing is going to be,
mm-hmm.
and then it's a question of getting creative with that. In this case, 50 ways, and so it's got its own challenges because sometimes. You know, you think, how many ways can you really make mac and cheese?
Right.
And although I discovered after doing 50 recipes, I could probably write another book on that too. But
mm-hmm.
But basically, it is a different process. And so, whereas in the first couple of books, and also my book Cheese Essentials, which is that one is driven by styles of cheese, so the recipes are meant to sort of bring to the table the kinds of cheeses that I'm writing about in each chapter. And whereas, you know, those are sort of more, I guess a little more traditional.
Mm-hmm.
These are just grilled cheese and mac and cheese are really more about figuring out how to divide, you know, the chapters. Should it be based on cheeses, or should it be based on how the recipe is made, if it's a stovetop recipe versus an oven-baked one?
Mm-hmm.
Or the way I did it was based on things like, you know, all vegetables or mm-hmm. all cheese or meat, and you know, the decadent kind of a chapter, that and a lower fat
right.
chapter, and that kind of thing.
Now, do you test your own recipes, or does the publisher then retest? What's the procedure?
No, actually, for my last three books, I hired a recipe tester.
Mm-hmm.
There is such a person in the world, or more than one, and she and I did not cook side by side. In fact, she lives in North Carolina, and I live in California. But she is a very, very experienced cook, and also an excellent writer. So what I did was I would do the recipes, and then if I had questions, or even if I didn't, I sent them to her, and then I had a form that I had her fill out,
mm-hmm.
including, you know, did you like it, did you sort of like it, did you not like it,
mm-hmm.
and if so, or and if not, why. You know, everything from kind of the aesthetic to the practical, you know, did the recipe work kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Right.
And so, because I don't think it's ever good for a recipe writer to test their own recipes, although I know many people might disagree with me that write their own recipes, but I don't think it's a good idea.
Okay. Well, have you tasted the recipes?
Have I tasted them?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I've created them.
Oh, okay, so you devise them and taste them, and then she tests them, the recipe
right.
tester.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
No, I come up with most of the recipes.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes I'll ask a chef friend of mine or somebody
mm-hmm.
or this guy, Kevin, who
right.
whose Velveeta recipe, I'll ask, you know, for that. But mostly
mm-hmm.
I create them.
Now, this is a question. You're my first total cookbook interview, so I, you know, have a lot of cookbook questions. How do you create a recipe and call it your own? Do you have to check, you know, maybe you got it 20 years ago from a magazine and then, you know, tweaked it? How do you make sure it's your own?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people say that there's no such thing as an original recipe, and
mm-hmm.
you know, that's probably true, although I think all of us who write recipes would like to think that our recipes are indeed unique.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that everybody's process, everybody who writes cookbooks, their process is different.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is that I actually choose not to look at other people's recipes. I think that sometimes that probably hurts me. I could perhaps learn from them, but I don't want to be influenced by anything but my own creative thoughts. And
mm-hmm.
for me, recipe creation is a real exercise in creativity. It's probably, for me, it's in some ways the most creative thing that I do, because
mm-hmm.
I don't draw. I can't even do a stick man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really love creating recipes, and so I'm not really influenced by recipes from others. But obviously, you know, I eat and I'm influenced by chefs and
right.
and all kinds of combinations of foods that, you know, the chefs put on the plate that you think, well, gee, you know, I really like butternut squash ravioli
mm-hmm.
with sage butter and
mm-hmm.
you know, Parmesan. So
I incorporate that into a mac and cheese recipe?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I did do that.
Mm-hmm.
I riffed on that in my own way. And, you know, so, I mean, I didn't use anybody's recipe, but certainly I'm inspired by things
right.
that I eat and see and all of that. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your previous life, before you were a cheese writer, were you the kind of cook that goes into the kitchen and cooks without a recipe?
Not really. I was an avid cook, but
mm-hmm.
I wasn't. I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of a rule follower.
Okay, so you will follow other recipes in other areas.
Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And only now do I buck that trend. I'm really not interested in following recipes. I like to use them now as guidelines, but
mm-hmm.
back then, no, I was a recipe follower, which served me well in terms of being a recipe writer, I'll tell you.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
I have another question. You don't dictate in the recipes, except for Velveeta and a few truffle cheeses and, you know, a few recipes. You don't dictate what brand type of cheese. You just say cheddar or Fontina or Parmesan. What price do you think people will use for mac and cheese? And I guess sort of what price will regular people use, and what price will cheese fanatics that might be listening to the show use?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I kept the recipes generic intentionally, because I felt like a mac and cheese book was meant to be for everyone. It was for the mm-hmm. people listening to this show, just as it is for the people, you know, who might not, who for whom cheese is essentially a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and even among cheese people, I think there's a philosophical divide about whether you cook with expensive cheeses or don't you.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you drill down further, then you think, well, what kind of recipes are you talking about? It's sort of like olive oil. Do you use the best olive oil to cook with, or do you use it as a finishing oil?
Right.
And the same, I would say, is true for cheese. You know, some of my more serious books, in there I call for very specific cheeses, and that's because I'm trying to educate people about those cheeses. But grilled cheese and mac and cheese, they're meant to be just, you know, sort of equal opportunity foods for everybody. And I don't want them, I did not want any of these books to seem kind of snobbish or elitist or cheesist, you know.
Right, right.
And so I can't really answer your question. I mean, I just think that whatever works or whatever you have in your fridge, that's why I remained sort of, you know, deliberately generic.
Okay, so I was wondering, were you being diplomatic or was it a, you know, thought-out policy? So you're pretty much saying it was thought out to make the book for everyone.
Yes, definitely, mm-hmm. unquestionably.
Okay. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back very soon on Cutting the Curd with Laura Werlin.
In the middle of a firestorm in the early morning light.
This song is called Firestorm Decline by Jen Jaden and the Greenstone, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Soldiers knocking at his front door, all over his mind of breath before he walks alive, embracing fetus, walks alive, embracing
We're back on Cutting the Curd with Laura Werlin, talking about her book, Mac and Cheese, Please, and other cheese-related topics. How are you doing, Laura?
I'm doing fine. I was just thinking about, you know, your last question, and I was thinking about how, sort of internally for me, it's always a bit of a dilemma to try to figure out who I should be talking to or who I want to be talking to when it comes to cheeses in recipes, because you know, a huge part of what I do is educate people about cheeses, and mostly American cheeses, but others too. And so, on one hand, I haven't wanted to dumb down what I do, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, I have wanted to do just that, because I feel like if we just keep talking about, you know, named cheeses that are that we all know in the cheese world, but that others don't, then we're going to keep it just sort of a talk amongst ourselves instead of, you know, reaching a larger group of people mm-hmm. that might be interested in these cheeses but don't know about them. And so I feel like, you know, I try to provide gateway books into cheese, and hopefully then that will mm-hmm. encourage them to explore further.
Right, right. And I can remember from working behind the counter at Murray's, selling people expensive cheese, they're not going to generally use it in recipes, though that may be changing too. And I think my use of good cheese has changed through the years. I'm more inclined to throw an expensive cheese into a recipe now than I used to.
Yeah, absolutely. I am too. But mm-hmm. that's us, and, you know, and there's a whole other world out there.
Right. What would it put you on the spot too much if I asked you, if you were cooking mac and cheese for a bunch of your foodiest friends, what would you put in it?
Well, in terms of cheeses, the ones that I would use would be I mean, not all in one mac and cheese, but generally my go-to cheeses for mac and cheese, if I'm being cheesist, is Italian fontina, because I love how mm-hmm. it melts, mm-hmm. and I like and I love using Comté, because mm-hmm. For the same reason, but it's a different kind of a flavor, certainly, than fontina, mm-hmm. but melts, you know, just as well. Basically, any cheeses that are made in the mountains of Switzerland, most mm-hmm. of them anyway, melt really well. Mm-hmm. I like all those. And then, but it also depends what kind of result I'm looking for, because, you know, those are the sort of traditional melting cheeses, but then there are the creamy cheeses. So one of the cheeses I use a lot is Rogue Creamery's Smoky Blue.
Ah.
Because what that does in a mac and cheese, you know, it's a smoked blue cheese for anybody that doesn't know, and what it does is it creates a bacony flavor in a mac and cheese, but of course there's no bacon, so it's great for vegetarians.
Oh, that's a great trick.
Well, I have a recipe for it, and in the mac and cheese book, it's smoky blue, leeks, and hazelnuts, and mm-hmm. I included the hazelnuts because those two are Oregon made, just as the cheese is, uh-huh. and I wanted to, and it all works together very nicely, but then I have mozzarella in there too to kind of, I always want to have a sort of a gooey mm-hmm. Cheese as well as one that's creamy in a mac and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I'll use, I mean, any cheese will work in a mac and cheese,
mm-hmm.
But it's a question of how, what you want it to do, like a pecorino or a parmigiano will work, but only on top,
uh-huh.
you know, for crunch and for cheesiness, and
right.
but not for melting,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
properties.
Okay. I have some questions also on the state of American cheese as we head into the 30th American Cheese Society meeting in Madison next week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how many meetings you have been to. Do you know?
Yeah, this will be my, wait, if I can do the math. Actually, this will be my 15th.
Oh, wow. So you've been there half the time.
I guess I have. I didn't even look at it that way until you just asked. Yeah.
That's great. Do you, is it your favorite week of the year, like so many other cheese people?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Festival of Cheese alone, my first conference was in Madison. That was in 1998.
Oh.
And I was a newbie. I hadn't written any books yet. I was exploring, really. I wanted to write my first book. And
uh-huh.
and I went there, and there were about 300 cheeses for tasting at the festival. And I think I must have tasted all 300. But
now you can't do that.
And most of them were bad. What?
Now you can't do that. There's no way you can taste all the cheeses
no,
at the festival.
1,700 cheeses or something like that. But I still so look forward to the festival, because I always learn about new cheeses that I haven't heard of there. And I'm just much more careful about how I navigate that,
yeah.
because, you know, it's hard to do. But yes, it's a very exciting week. There's a lot of, there are great seminars that are being held. As I said, I learn at these every time I go. And, you know, the more you learn, the more there is to learn, it seems like, in cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, the conference week, really brings that home in the very best way.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Now, if you can go back to when you were first writing your first book on the new American cheesemaker, or when it was just an idea, what did you expect to happen with American cheese when you were first researching those cheesemakers?
Well, let me back up. When I was in TV news, my job, I was called the assignment manager,
mm-hmm.
and what my job was to figure out what to cover for the news, basically to predict what was going to be important by 5 o'clock, you know, that evening.
Okay.
And so I had kind of, an ear or an eye or both for what was going to become something,
mm-hmm.
In a way.
Predicting trends.
Well, in a way, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that definitely informed, you know, my desire to write a book. Not my desire to write the book, but my reason for wanting to write the book. I knew that that we were on the verge of something. I just could feel it with absolutely no basis for saying that. It was
mm-hmm.
just a gut feeling. And part of what informed that is that at the time I lived in Berkeley, and I shopped at a place called The Pasta Shop, which
mm-hmm.
I'm sure many of your listeners know,
right.
in Oakland, and it's you know, it's a fantastic cheese shop. And I remember seeing a cheese from Colorado, and I thought, Colorado cheese, wow, you know. And in the meantime, at the San Francisco Farmers Market that I went to almost every week, there were cheesemakers like Cowgirl Creamery and Bellwether
mm-hmm.
Farms and Redwood Hill, And I made a beeline to those tables every every week because I wanted to taste their cheeses. I wanted to talk to the cheesemakers and all of that. So I guess...
You had sensed something was going on.
I did. And in a way, I also, even if I didn't sense that, I didn't, in a way, I didn't care because all I knew was that I had to write about these cheesemakers that were my heroes. They just were.
Now, were you, had you decided to leave TV news and become a writer? And you just, and cheese was your first topic?
Actually, it wasn't my first topic. I left to become a food writer, and I wrote an article. My very first article was published in Self magazine, and it was on exotic root vegetables.
Oh, okay.
And, but then I went to my first conference of the International Association of Culinary Professionals, the IACP, and there they have cookbook awards, and I was sitting in the auditorium a bit forlorn, you know, surrounded by a bunch of people I didn't know who were all in the food industry, and I was very inspired, and I thought, well, if I were to write a book, what would it be about? And I answered that question in about a nanosecond. I knew it was cheese. And then in the next 4 seconds, I knew it was American cheese. And I kid you not, there was no turning back. That was it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. What has surprised you either about your cheese career or your writing career or the cheese world? What has surprised you?
Wow. Well, I guess, what has surprised me? In a way, I'm not so surprised by anything. I mean, in terms of, I mean, no, I did not set out to write 6 books on cheese, that's for sure. So so personally, you know, I set out to write my first book. I didn't think beyond that. And so everything that has happened since has really just been sort of organic, I would say, on my part. But also, luckily, you know, in keeping with what has happened with the interest and growth of cheese in this country, and so I feel very lucky that I got, you know, that I happened to
you got in on the ground floor.
Yeah, basically. So for me, that's kind of, you know, it's all been a surprise. Even writing a book in the first place was sort of a surprise because I didn't set out to be an author. But anyway, but in terms of American cheese or you know, as a whole, I guess what has been interesting or surprising maybe is the speed at which it has changed and grown. And because when I was first writing about cheese, everything was called cheddar or Gruyere. It was, you know, they were cheeses for the most part anyway, named for the European, you know, antecedents and to those cheeses. And then little by little, you know, cheesemakers have been naming cheeses for their for whatever they wanted to name them for, and so that has been that's been a wonderful trend to see because back when everything was named the same thing, I felt like it worked against American cheese because the inevitable comparisons
and they were being too derivative. They were sort of not striking out on their own.
Well, not only that, their cheeses didn't compare.
Right.
Frankly,
right?
You know, they just weren't that good, and in comparison to the original, so. So there was that, and then. But what has been really interesting to me is watching the growth of cheese making in places where you wouldn't expect it, and also so that would be for me that would be the South. I think that's just been really amazing to watch these fantastic cheeses coming out of places like Tennessee and North Carolina and Texas and Georgia and Virginia. That. You know, kind of unlikely, or it would seem to me, unlikely places for cheese. But then what has also maybe been most surprising is to see what's happened primarily in Wisconsin and in California, which are both traditionally dairy, well, Wisconsin, of course, is a dairy state, and California, Northern California, has traditionally been, you know, dairy land also in Marin and Sonoma counties. And but they sort of... They had their kind of, I don't know, strong time periods of time, but then they kind of went, they plateaued. And now Marin and Sonoma County there is are homes to fantastic new cheeses and cheesemakers. And then Wisconsin, what it has done, I guess I never expected for it to be be able to sort of foster the growth of the industry in a modern way, mm-hmm. where you have all these fantastic farmstead cheeses and cheesemakers doing things that are not traditional in Wisconsin, and yet are being embraced within Wisconsin. And I just think that has been really fun to see. And of course, we cheese lovers are all the beneficiaries of mm-hmm. these innovations and growth and kind of going back to their roots, but in a modern way.
I think that's what's exciting about having the meeting in Madison this year.
Absolutely.
That there's, there's just a lot more, I guess, farmstead or artisanal cheeses that have come out of Wisconsin, where we used to think of it as sort of a big cheese state. Now it's both. It's both a little cheese state and a big cheese state, and they're, I think they're quite friendly.
Yes, yes. No, that's exactly. I couldn't agree more. And and because of that, I think that they're setting a very good example for what else can happen. You know, pretty much anywhere. And in fact, I would say that to go back to your question about the changes or surprises, I guess one of the things that's been surprising to me, in a good way, has been to see how many people who never had experience on a farm are, moving to farms and because of cheese. Mm-hmm. They want to, they want to make cheese. And I think sometimes when they get there, they wonder what they were doing,
right.
making that decision. But what that means, in good ways and in bad, actually, is that they, to some degree, are helping to raise the bar on the quality of cheese. And that's a good thing, but they're not the only ones, of course. People that have no money are doing the same thing. But also, the bad part is that, for me anyway, is that sometimes I think that the people that have money do it because they think it's kind of cool, and I'm not sure that they bring soul into it. And
mm-hmm.
and what happens is that they're just kind of sanitized operations. Their cheeses are very predictable, but not necessarily in the best way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I don't love seeing.
Right.
But you take the good with the bad.
Right. And I think there's a lot of snobism in the cheese world about where people fall on that spectrum.
Well, there is. One of the things that's always been troubling to me is that, and you can see this in the sort of trajectory of my books, is that. What I was saying before, I do feel like cheese can be a very sort of a classist kind of a thing,
mm-hmm.
a kind of a food. And, I don't know what to make of that.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, should everybody in the world be able to eat cheese? I mean, you certainly think that when you go to, when you go to France,
right.
It does, you can buy a wheel of Vacherin Mont d'Or for about, $10, and
mm-hmm.
here it's about 30.
Right.
And it isn't just because it's imported,
mm-hmm.
and it's the premium. It's the cost of doing business here.
Right.
There are a lot of reasons for it. There isn't just one. But
well, it seems like peasant food. It really seems mm-hmm. like hearty peasant food that you should just be having a chunk of at the table. Unfortunately, I see our time is up. We've been chatting so much. I want to thank you for coming on the show, Laura Worland. Thank you very much, and I hope everyone goes out and tries your Mac and Cheese Please book. And we can all have mac and cheese for weeks.
Thank you, Diane.
And this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. You can listen to a podcast on iTunes, and you can find us on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.